You're listening to the Unofficial Expression Engine Podcast, episode number 82. Today, we're talking about contracts and business practices with special guest, Paul Burton. I'm your host, Leia Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
This episode is sponsored by Focus Lab. Focus Lab LLC is an EE shop who believes in the power of teamwork. If you need help planning, debugging, developing, or even training on an EE project, give Focus Lab a call and ask for Eric Regan or online at focuslabllc.com/EE podcast.
The Expression Engine Podcast would also like to thank Pixel and Tonic for being our major sponsor of the year. Hi, Leia. So good to have you back. How are you feeling?
Much better now that I can speak in full sentences instead of croaks.
I'm glad you're back to the land of the living and the speaking. You know, since you were out for our post-EECI episode, I was hoping you might share your thoughts about the conference.
Well, I was really relieved and happy I was able to attend. Even the brief time I was there, I thought the show we had was a blast. And you really can't put a price on the conversations you have and the people you meet. So even though I was only there for a brief day, even in a day, I was still able to make some new connections and reconnect with old friends.
I was so happy you made it, just so you were there with me for the live podcast. But, you know, you and I, we never see each other. So it's so nice to be able to, you know, be in person with each other.
I agree. Like I said before, that EECI has become kind of the new South by Southwest sort of for me. So, you know, I was disappointed to find out that it was going to be Wooz's last official one. So for me, that made the Turner Parscale announcement
right, all
the more sweet. So for those that don't know, Brad Parscale of Dev Demon fame, along with Tom Turner, who runs a venture capital firm, joined together as Turner Parscale, and they've purchased the rights to EECI. So Brad's been a dedicated part of the community, and it's really great to see that EECI has been turned over to capable hands.
Yeah, I'm sure everyone in the community is glad to know that there will be something moving forward, especially from someone who's so professional and part of the community. And I also know that in addition to, you know, what will come from EECI next year, there are a lot more local groups and meetups getting active, and I expect to see even more opportunities for our community to get together.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to that. So, yeah, let's get on to today's topic. We'll be talking less about EE development and more about business today. Not only do I know this is a topic near and dear to both our hearts, our listeners seem to agree. Talking about Brad Parscale, our Selling EE podcast with him as our guest was the top pick in our listener survey.
Right. So continuing with this more businessy theme, we've got Paul Burton on the show today to talk about business practices and contracts. Paul is a man of many talents, an artist, illustrator, web designer, and expression engine developer, to name a few. He's the co-founder and lead creative for the award-winning 16 Toads Web Consultancy, which has been a member of the EE Pro Network for over 4 years. Welcome, Paul. Thank you for joining the podcast today.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me on.
Thanks for being here. So to start off, I'm curious, 16 Toads, it's a very unique name for a web agency. So what's the story behind that?
Well, in a nutshell, 16 is the day that I was born, so it's my lucky number. And Toad is a nickname that a friend of mine gave me back in my undergraduate art school days because I gave her a lot of shit for using too much green in her paintings. So, and it's been memorable, so it's worked pretty well.
Cool. So how long have you been running 16 Toads?
I've been in the business, well, actually, it's the 2013 will mark 18 years in the business.
Holy.
16 Toads came about after the web bubble burst in 2001.
Okay. And have you always been an expression engine shop?
Yes and no. I went through, prior to finding Expression Engine, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, I'd gone through almost a 2-year period where I was testing different content management systems. Mm-hmm. And it was a result of having, you know, as the business grew and web technology improved, I started receiving more and more phone calls from potential clients asking for content management systems. And at the time, I had no idea what they were. Mm-hmm. So part of growing the business then was to start researching different CMSs. And I went through a period where I worked with The very first one was .NET Nuke, which was an absolute nightmare.
I hate that.
it was a horrible experience. And then from there, I went on to Joomla and Drupal and Simple CMS. And eventually, you know, after discovering that there were certain aspects of all of those systems that either I wasn't able to learn or I wasn't able to design around, I found EE doing a search for, I believe it was just something like content management systems for designers. Mm. And EE was one of the ones that came up. So I just tried it out and I loved it. And that was the end of the story.
And since then, has Expression Engine been exclusively the platform you're using for content management systems?
Yes and no. It depends on the project, depends on the client and what their needs are. Mm-hmm. But it has been a core part of the business. But for me, it's always been a tool.
Yeah, I feel the same way. It always does for me come down to the client and the project. So speaking of that, when you are evaluating a project, what are some of the key things you are on the lookout for to determine what CMS is the right tool?
Well, the primary one, and this is a question that I ask all clients, is that even the ones that ask me for content management systems or they're shopping around for a CMS to use for their business, the first question I ask is, are they actually going to use it? Mm-hmm. And if they come back and say, well, you know, we don't really have the staff internally to be able to maintain it, then that kind of leads to some other questions in terms of what they're actually going to use. If EE is, for me anyway, it's a means to an end for a more complicated website. It can do so much that it doesn't make a lot of sense for me to either do the work myself or hire someone to do the work mm-hmm. to develop the site if all the client needs is the ability to say, change a few pieces of content, you know, text within the website over the course of a month or something like that. If they're not going to be maintaining a blog, if they're not going to be maintaining a portfolio or, you know, case study section of the website or something along those lines, or if they don't have any more requirements that are technical in nature, then EE may not be the best fit, which case then we'll start shopping around for, you know, something else that may or may not work.
So I'm curious, you mentioned how sometimes clients come to you shopping for CMSs. Do most clients that approach you already have a CMS in mind, or do they basically rely on you to make some sort of recommendation?
Both. Ugh. Both. I would say that it's about 50-50.
Okay.
The clients that come to me who, I guess for lack of a better way of describing it, are more web savvy. And that could mean that they've either already gone through the process of building a website or they've just done a lot of research in terms of sites that they like, features that are on their wish list, and things down the road that they want to be able to accomplish with their site. Those folks typically come to me having said, okay, well, we've already talked to a few people. These are the systems that were recommended to us. We've done our research on these systems. And, you know, we found you via whatever it may be, whether it was a referral or the Expression Engine Pro Network or something along those mm-hmm. lines. Those are the folks that typically have some kind of idea what they're looking for. They don't necessarily know what the best solution is. Mm-hmm. And that's why they're shopping around for that solution. Now, the other side of the coin is the folks that are, again, for lack of a better way of describing it, not very web savvy. They just need a website. They have a basic idea of what it is they want to accomplish, but don't have any idea what's out there in terms of a solution. My experience has been that, well, actually, I'm not even going to make that statement. I was going to say that the folks that don't necessarily know what they're looking for are a little bit more fun to work with, but sometimes that's not the case. From my own perspective, I tend to like clients that are a little bit more of a blank slate, but still have enough of an idea of what they're looking for to give me the foundation to build a solution around.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that sometimes you get clients that find you through the EE Pro Network. Has that, being a part of the network, has that helped you land new clients? I mean, I'm personally not a member. Leah, are you?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
So, I mean, being a member, does that help you get new clients?
Very little. Very little, to be perfectly honest. I do get a lot of referrals from the Pro Network. The problem is that the folks that are looking for shops on the Pro Network are usually sending out shotgun blasts to everyone. In Pro Network, you know, in which case there isn't any way. I haven't won a single one of those jobs yet because I can't compete on a cost basis for people that are looking, that are doing that kind of shopping, so to speak, for a web professional. So it hasn't really benefited me other than being able to have my logo up on the site and another link back to me.
Yeah, it's pretty much the same experience for myself as well.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Well, then I don't need to have that at the top of my list then. So, Paul, working with EE in general, especially for those projects that have a high level of technical requirements, has that, you know, before you sign the client, having EE in your tool belt, is that kind of one of the clinchers for getting those more technical projects?
In general, yes. It helps a lot just from a sales standpoint that, well, I'm going to approach this from two different angles because my emphasis within my business is design. I am a begrudging programmer, and I've learned over the last couple of years that I'm not very good at it. You know, good enough to be able to build some complex sites, but I don't know all of the tricks to really make code pretty. I've been contracting out my development work over the past couple of years. In fact, I've done very little development work. That being said, from a sales standpoint, EE is a wonderful thing because, as I mentioned, many of the clients or potential clients that I speak with or deal with have already gone through the process of looking at other CMS platforms. And it's been a somewhat easy sale for me to be able to kind of describe the differences between EE, what it offers in terms of not only ease of use for the end user and also the administrator, but also from a design standpoint. Drupal, for example, you're not really developing how's the best way to put this? The benefit of EE is that from a design perspective, I can create a design and then wrap the content management system around the design. Whereas with other content management systems, you're basically given a template structure and you have to figure out a way to fit that design into the template structure, which means that ultimately it's not all that flexibility from a visual standpoint. Mm-hmm. That was why I ended up with EE, and it's been one of the primary selling points for my business in selling content management systems over the years. I've got somewhat of a design style, but virtually every site that I build is custom in that I'm trying not to repeat design solutions from one client to the next. It's all about, you know, what the client is looking for. So for me as a designer, that has been the way that I've approached selling a project to a client that's looking for a custom design more than anything else.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like with other systems that I've taken a look at, there's, because of that rigid template structure, a lot of those styles are starting to look exactly the same. Like I can spot a WordPress site a mile away.
Yeah. You know? And in some ways, the interesting thing is that's happening in the EE community too.
Sure.
You know, particularly with the advent of responsive design, you're starting to see a lot of design solutions that look exactly like something else someone did, or even for that matter, a WordPress site.
Mm-hmm. Now, and this is to both of you, do either of you think that's a negative or a good thing for the EE community that we have, you know, that we're seeing, you know, sites that reflect the work on other sites, you know, the design solution on one applied to another, more genericized, I guess?
I'm not 100% sure that it's really related to Expression Engine per se, as opposed to the actual responsive design movement. I think with any new technique that comes out, people struggle with standardization and trying to figure out what to do. So before they try to be more creative, they just try to figure it out in the first place. So I think
that's a good point.
You know, so I think that's part of the reason why there's a certain look right now. I think as people get more comfortable with the restrictions and the technology itself, there's probably going to be more room for creativity as it matures. But right now, it's funny because it's really pushing a certain type of aesthetic that has always existed, really. It's not like, you know, typography or minimalism types of design or sites never existed before responsive web design. It's just that how can we adapt without making everything look exactly the same? I think there's a difference between people arguing between standardization. For example, there's, you know, rhythm and contrast and good typography that never changes no matter what platform you're using. But if everyone's starting to use the same typeface simply because it's available, and then the same, you know, exact white space layout, one column design, then, you know, that doesn't really necessarily mean there's much thought about the actual solution as much, you know, or goal. It's just let's get this done so it works. I feel like that's what it seems like to me for now.
So it's like part of a cycle because we're all starting to explore and experiment with responsive design and how to get the job done.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know. Paul, what do you think?
I would agree entirely with that synopsis. I don't think that the direction of design in the larger web community nowadays has anything really to do with the technical underpinnings of a website, meaning whether it's attached to a content management system or not. It just has more to do with the fact that the big arguments within the responsive community is mobile-first design or designing for a mobile device before you get to the desktop. I don't necessarily agree with that because I think there's a point at which simplification becomes too simple. And if you take a web design and you're working with a client and that client gives you brand guidelines or they have a vision for their site, they want it to look like something. And I can't remember, is it skeuomorphic design that people are complaining about nowadays where everything, you know, looks like something real.
Yeah.
I actually like skeuomorphic design. And I read a really good article recently in defense of Apple and their rationale behind skeuomorphic design is because it gives something, there's a symbol there. There's something for people to latch onto. It makes instant sense when you open a calendar. It looks like a calendar. As much as I do like simple design and I work towards simplicity in my own designs, I also believe that or very strongly that the design itself has to in some way, shape, or form relate back to the client.
Yeah.
So when people are arguing that everything needs to be simple because it has to work on a mobile device, my first response to that is bullshit. You know, it's up to us as designers to figure out solutions. And if it's more difficult to take a graphic that you create for a website or a pattern that you create for a website and figure out a way to scale that down to fit on a mobile device, well, guess what? That's kind of what you need to do. So from the standpoint of working from a mobile-first perspective, I do have an issue with the argument that everything needs to be flat color and simple. Mm-hmm. There's a soapbox issue that's buried in there as well that I'm going to stay away from right now for the purpose of this discussion.
Yeah.
But, you know, the simple fact is like if you look at it from the standpoint that you've got game designers that are building these just incredibly beautiful interfaces for an iPhone, and then you have web designers saying, well, because of responsive design, we have to keep things simple, there's kind of a contradiction there. That doesn't make a hell of a lot of sense to me because if you can build something for a game that is incredibly detailed on a mobile device and you're starting mobile first, well, then you should be able to figure out a way to transition that to a website as well.
Mm-hmm. Are you getting clients coming to you with responsive as one of their requirements?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So when you get those sorts of clients, do they come with preconceived notions of what that means, or is that a huge education process for you?
I'd say it's more of an education process. What I deal with more than anything for clients that come to me for web design and particularly for developing systems, you know, whether it's content management system or e-commerce, is they know buzzwords. Mm-hmm. You know, they've heard responsive, they've heard people talk about it, maybe they read an article, but they don't really have any idea how it works, how it's supposed to work, or how much work is involved in building it. So the preconceived notion that they come with is that, okay, well, we're just building a website and we need it to be responsive. What I end up having to do then, and what I imagine most people in our position has to do then, is explain to them that, well, it's going to cost X amount of dollars more for us to do this because the time involved in creating a responsive website based on what you want is going to be X number of hours more than even you anticipated. I've had very little luck. Well, I don't want to say luck. It's just that most of the clients that come to me are small to medium-sized businesses. I do work with some large companies as well. And even the large companies don't have the budget to be able to create a responsive site. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the time, what that ends up meaning is they're looking at some like canned web-based solutions where you can basically plug your website into this machine that spits out a responsive or a web-based site. So the companies that I've worked with in the past have built a specific mobile site instead of a responsive site because it ends up being cheaper, or they already have a website that's built and the cost to retrofit that would be more than just simply starting over and building a mobile version. Mm. So it's been an interesting process. The more people that I talk with, the more frequently having a website that works fluidly from a desktop version to an iPad to an iPhone or another mobile device comes up more and more frequently.
Mm-hmm. Now, sort of changing tacks a little bit, I wanted to ask you about your Don't Call Me a Freelancer presentation.
Yep.
What's wrong with the term freelancer from your perspective?
Well, in a very general sense, in preparation for that talk, I spoke with a number of friends and colleagues who are not only owners of businesses who hire out for creative labor or creative vendors, but are also, you know, have positions such as creative directors, associate creative directors, or maybe they're just media buyers for companies. And the biggest problem that I have is that freelancer carries a connotation with it, whether you like it or not. You are a hired gun. And that means that you are a temporary solution for a problem. Mm-hmm. And the companies, or the folks that I spoke with in preparation for the talk, you know, gave me a list of things. When I say the word freelancer, what does that mean to you? And, you know, there's everything came up from, well, they're too expensive, they're not reliable, you know, they're only in it for a short period of time. It's hard to get them on the phone. And there was just a litany of, for all intents and purposes, negativity that came out in terms of dealing with freelancers. And I've experienced that on my own as well. You know, my business is small. It's primarily me. But I do work with quite a few different developers and designers. And over the years, I've been able to whittle that list down to people that are actually reliable or mm-hmm. talented, or talented and reliable. And I've run into some of the same problems. Like the biggest problem that I have, particularly because I farm out my development, is finding developers who pick up the damn telephone.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm sure there are a lot of people that can relate to that. It's a difficult thing. So for me, freelancing is, I don't look at freelancing as a legitimate business that can go the long haul. When I started in this business 18 years ago, I called myself a freelancer because I didn't know any other way to describe myself.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I was literally doing project-to-project work. I wasn't at that time, you know, savvy enough to be able to say, okay, I'm going to upsell this client on this, that, or the other thing, because the work that I was doing was everything from storyboards for advertisements to illustration, and then eventually, you know, getting into web banner ads and things like that. So as my business grew, I started understanding and realizing a few things, and that's that if I wanted to succeed, I had to start treating me and my business as an actual business. And that meant that I had to start approaching projects from the standpoint that I'm not just a hired gun. I am a partner.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the sales, you know, the whole idea of learning how to sell myself as a business came into play. The bottom line is, like, the word freelance actually bothers me because it has the word free in it.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you how many clients I've had that says, man, you charge a lot of money for being a freelancer. Mm-hmm. And my first response is, A, I'm not a freelancer. And B, I'm really good at what I do. And if anything, I'm undercharging for my work. So I would like to see the industry as a whole move away from the term freelancing. And I don't care if you call yourself an independent creative God, I don't care. It's just freelancing in and of itself is not something that that I think benefits the community as a whole.
You said in the beginning you refer to yourself as a freelancer, and the nature of your project sort of reflected that. When you made the decision to focus on your business in a different way, how did you change the conversation? How were you referring to yourself when you made that transition?
Well, when I made the transition, I just started calling myself an independent. I pen that with independent creative, independent web designer, whatever it may be. I called myself a small business as well, or an independent web studio. So I came up with all sorts of terms that would help get around that connotation that I'm a freelancer. And that came about more than anything because I started doing more. I started specializing in certain areas. I started becoming extremely proficient in certain areas. So it made sense to start building up the business, for lack of a better way of putting it. There's a certain level that everybody gets to where we try to sound bigger than we are. You know, I was never dishonest with my clients in saying that 16 Toes is primarily a one-man shop, and I've got a network of people that I work with depending upon a specific need. And that's the one thing that I think helps separate me from some of the other shops in town. When I changed the name of my business to 16 Toes in 2001, I was one of six independent web design studios in the entire city of Atlanta.
Wow.
Now there are over 300. So fast forward 10 years, there are over 300. And the interesting thing was, at that time, in 2001, probably through 2004 and 5, I was doing a tremendous amount of work for advertising agencies and interactive agencies in town. And the funny thing was, is none of them had web designers or developers on staff. They were farming out all their work to people like me. You know, since then, I don't have any of those clients any longer because they pulled out of that work in-house. They finally saw the need for it. to specifically answer your question, when I made the transition or I made the decision to transition from a freelancer to a business, that's when I started getting serious about things like using contracts and, you know, protecting my rights as an independent creative professional. There were a number of things that I did on the business side to start taking my business more seriously. It was a fairly long process, and I got into the business the way no one should. For as much, you know, proselytizing as I do about starting off with emergency funds and all of that crap, I didn't do anything right when I started off. But that's just the way things worked out.
Yeah, I didn't have emergency funds. I had a I'm tired of this job day. So when you said it was a fairly long process becoming moving from freelancer to a small business, was that something that was the process just on your end in terms of, you know, firming up your contracts, firming up your business practices, or was it also a transition on the end of prospects and clients perceiving you as a business?
All of the above.
Yeah,
all of the above. The thing that I started realizing, and this goes back to why I don't like the term freelancers, is when I was working with clients in town, they would always refer to me as a freelancer. Mm-hmm. And that always brought up the money conversation. Oh, you charge too much, or oh, you do this, that, or the other thing, or oh, how can we trust you? And I started to kind of understand that there's a dynamic that happens when you call yourself a freelancer, is that you're always going to be answering those questions. And to get to the point where clients trusted me, I needed to have some kind of backbone in the company that said, okay, well, this guy actually takes his work seriously. And that came in. It came into play particularly with using a contract. When I started working with clients, I'd always read contracts, you know, because even as a freelancer, you're given contracts, whether they're, mm-hmm. you know, non-disclosure agreement, a full contract, or some kind of working agreement, whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. I always took that very seriously, and I did that even in my first year in business because I had mentors who were very insistent on you need to take this stuff seriously. So I always did. That being said, using a contract was able to help provide a perception to the client that I was a professional. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And based on my experience for, I think, 5 or 6 years of my business, or the early years of my business, that perception was invaluable because I stopped becoming just, you know, somebody that came in to help on a specific project, and I started becoming someone that they could call if they needed help. Mm-hmm. And that's how I started, you know, getting into working for some of the ad agencies in town. I was never put on retainer, mind you, but I was always the go-to resource for these folks. And the only reason that came about is because I started becoming, in their eyes, more reliable. Yep. And that came about as a result of the practices I put in place to make myself be more reliable and be more accountable to the work that I was doing.
As you made the switch, did you try to push your own agreement more, or do you always work with their agreement? How does that work in terms of whose contract do you sign?
Okay. That's actually a really interesting question, because that was another area of my business that required years of experience to kind of understand how to use a contract. In the early years, my contract was basically an estimate with a signature field, all right, with a few terms that help protect me from an intellectual property standpoint and also to help me get paid. When I started taking contracts very seriously, that was when I sat down and I started doing research. You know, I looked through the AIGA, mm-hmm. or I should say, looked to the AIGA and the Graphic Artists Guild for advice on how to write contracts. I also used a book called Graphic Artists Guild Guidelines for something or other. It's a book that they produce that it's basically kind of a compendium of all of the different creative fields and gives you an idea of, you know, what people are charging for everything from illustration to web design to writing and all of these things. In any case, my initial contract I wrote myself, and it was a piece of shit. It wouldn't have stood up in court at all.
Interesting.
But it was the first steps that I took, and it did help. It helped create a foundation for me to start understanding how contracts work. But by the same token, to get back to the question, for a number of years, it was about a 50-50 ratio, again, where I was the one providing the contract or signing contracts with companies. Now, the larger the company, the more likely they're going to require that you sign their contract. Mm-hmm. All right. That's just the way that it works. That doesn't necessarily mean that you can't send them a contract yourself and say, well, I need you to sign my contract too.
Oh,
didn't even think about that.
Me either. Yeah.
So for a few years, I was signing contracts with other companies, and the only thing that I was really looking for at that time were clauses within that contract that would prohibit me from running my own business. One of the other questions that you asked in some of the pre-questions were involved work for hire. And that is absolutely a soapbox issue for me. But that being said, it was also one of the things that my mentor said, you need to watch out for this because of the fact that it really does prohibit your ability to run a business. There's also non-disclosure agreements. Not non-disclosure agreements, but non-compete agreements, a number of other things that will fall into those categories. So I was always very, very good about looking for those clauses within contracts. And if I ever found them, I would go back to the company and say, listen, I have an issue with this. We either need to revise it or remove it from the contract. And I would lose lots of jobs as a result of that. But I was always protecting my business because I refused to sign any work agreement whatsoever that would limit my ability to work in, particularly in Atlanta at the time. Over the years, however, I would say over the past 5 or 6 years, I haven't signed a contract provided by a client in that time.
Oh, interesting.
Is the one that's providing my contract. The contract that I currently have was vetted by an attorney last year. I don't rewrite, but I revise my contract every single year. I go back and I look at it and say, okay, well, this is where the industry is going. These are the things that I need to take into account, or this is where I want my business to go, and these are the items that I need to revise. And as a result, I've got a contract it's long. It is full of legalese. It is as airtight as I can make it. And I have provisions within it that are kind of plug and play. So if I'm doing a development job, I can put in development language. If I'm doing design language and illustration language and what have you. But it gives me enough flexibility that I can create a somewhat customized contract based on the type of job that I get, but it also protects me. The other side of the issue is that I also have language in the contract that protects the client.
Such as?
In terms of the items within a contract that clients have the most problem with, it usually boils down to intellectual property, like what the project is due. So my intellectual property clauses are very specific in terms of what the client owns, when they own it, and you know what that means for the future. Beyond that, some of the clauses that I typically have issues with relate to cancellation fees or termination fees. How, if worse comes to worse, it does go to court, you know, what the client is responsible for, what I'm responsible for. Those are the types of things that I actually don't mind negotiating, because what they're doing then is focusing on some of the mechanics of the contract rather than the actual language that protects my business.
Mm-hmm. So when you mentioned that you had your contract recently vetted by a lawyer, and you also mentioned that you revise your contract every year. So with every revision, do you have a lawyer review it?
I try to, yeah. Mm-hmm. It depends on, again, how specific the changes are. My contract, for all intents and purposes, is kind of an amalgamation of contracts that I've been able to view from friends and colleagues who run businesses who I respect. And depending upon, you know, or who you go to for advice, you know, everybody has a way of approaching a contract. Every lawyer has a different way of writing a contract. And the purpose is to create something that covers you entirely, you know, from beginning to end. There are a lot of, you know, different components in a contract that need to be there in order to do that. With that thought, I'm going to answer one of the other questions that you had in your pre-questions, and that was, is a more common language approach with very little legalese more appropriate than a contract that is, you know, absolutely airtight from a legal standpoint? The answer to that question is my perspective, pretty simple. I'm not a lawyer. I don't necessarily understand all of the intricacies of law. When you are in court, particularly when it comes to dealing with someone who is paying you money for a service, whatever that may be, it is essential that you have a contract that works with the law. And there's a reason why lawyers write contracts that you and I probably don't understand from a language standpoint. And that's because what lawyers are doing when they're writing contracts is writing clauses that are oblique enough that gives them multiple angles to defend you with.
Right.
So if you write a common language contract, like Andy Clark suggested in his Contract Killer article, what you're essentially doing is simplifying your contract to the point that you may not have a legal foot to stand on.
Mm. Wow.
It's too clear cut, and if it's too specific, even if your son could read it and understand it, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to hold up in court.
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea of having a contract like that is something that I don't want to criticize it, but the bottom line is I'd never walk into court with a contract that my lawyer wasn't perfectly comfortable defending.
Well, speaking of what the lawyer brings to the table and kind of having something not too specific so they can work with that in the chance that you do end up having to go to court. How did you find a lawyer that, do you have to find a lawyer that understands contracts or contracts and IT or someone who just understands IT? I mean, is it a specialty for, you know, a lawyer who does contracts for, you know, web design, illustration?
That's a really good question. And it has been kind of one of the banes of my business over the years. I worked with a lawyer for a number of years. He was somewhat of a specialist in contract law. Now, lawyers, just like web designers and developers, have their specialties. So there's intellectual property law, there's contract law, there's business law, and it goes on and on and on. And they don't all specialize in the same things. Even more to the point, there are very few lawyers that specialize specifically in either the IT world or the creative world or the design world. So finding that person is like finding a needle in a haystack.
Mm-hmm.
The guy that I worked with didn't have any experience in web design or development or, you know, the technical fields when he started working with me. And it was really up to me to work with him to help understand, like, these are the types of things that we're going to have to deal with from a product and a service standpoint. It was an interesting process. You know, that being said, the guy that I work with is no longer a lawyer, and I'm currently without a lawyer.
Interesting.
When I do revise my contracts, I work with a couple different people now to help me do that. So I hire them basically on a time and materials basis moving forward.
Now, you also mentioned, you know, some of the elements that you make sure you have in a contract, like a termination clause, a work for hire clause, intellectual property. Can you be a little specific about more about what you include in your contracts? And one of the things that's coming to my mind, and this is in reference to Andy Clark's Contract Killer. He even posted yesterday, he's made a revision to it to accommodate, if I recall correctly, responsive techniques. So when you have your contract, in addition to sort of the legal stuff to protect your business and protect the client, do you get specific about what the project includes down to, these are the browsers I support, this is the type of responsive design that will be included?
The answer to that question is yes and no, and it depends entirely on the type of work that comes in. To date, I don't get that specific in terms of, you know, what browsers it includes, because frankly, that's a topic that I want to try to avoid. You know, once you start walking down that road, then it leads to a much more complicated discussion with the client. But I do, however, say that, you know, I make a somewhat general statement in terms of, you know, we will make sure that your site or, you know, mobile, whatever it may be, will work in X number of browsers. And we just say, okay, Safari, Firefox, Chrome, and Internet Explorer. There are certain things that I try not to be too specific about, and that would be an example of one of them.
And is that because of what you said with regard to, you know, if this does have to go to court, having things not too specific so that the lawyer can sort of work around it? Or is that to keep your project open in case things happen?
For me, it's more to keep the project open in case something happens, whether it's, you know, something going right or something going wrong. I do like to have as much flexibility as I can, which brings up another relatively kind of important point. My contract, in, you know, I refer to my contract as my contract, but it's really my master services agreement. And all it does is establishes the working relationship that I have with my client. I don't put any project specific items in my contract at all. So the contract covers all of the legal things, everything from, you know, recitals and services to cooperation to deliverables to IP information to warranties to fees, confidentiality, and all the general provisions, including, you know, things like force majeure and governing law. So that's what my master services agreement is. And that services agreement is typically signed once with a client. And the assumption is that I'm going to continue working with these people. So they should only have to sign that document once. The master services agreement establishes the business relationship or the foundation for the business relationship. All of the project specific items I put in a statement of work. And what that is it's an addendum to the contract that basically just spells out, this is the project, this is what we're doing, this is how we're proposing, or these are the solutions that we're proposing for whatever items we have to cover. and this is what you can expect from us from a timeline. This is what you can expect from us from a, you know, cost perspective. And even in that document, the project document, I've gotten to the point now where it's relatively short and concise, and I try not to get into too many specifics because I don't want my statement of work to essentially create a solution for me. I need to have that flexibility along the way that says, okay, well, we ran into this issue, so we have to go back and redo this, or we have a better idea to do something. I found over the years, in one of my original long contracts, I took pains to include every single detail of every single thing that found that to be incredibly limiting. Mm-hmm. I was basically establishing a solution on paper, and that, particularly from a development standpoint, doesn't work. Because a lot of the times when I would have to double back and say, well, you know, this idea that we had, we found out that it's not really going to work. And then the client would start pushing back and saying, well, you promise. Mm. And that, you know, in a very general sense, turned out to be somewhat detrimental for a number of projects. So I started pulling specifics out and eventually got to the point where I completely separated the project-related items from the contract itself, so that if we did have something like a scope change or ran into a technical problem along the way, that we would be able to deal with it in the statement of work and not have to redo the entire contract.
Mm-hmm. So the statement of work doesn't get too specific, but does that include things like, for example, with Expression Engine add-ons, do you specify anything in your statement of work about who purchases it, who has the licenses to it, or is that one of those things that's just too specific?
Well, in terms of licensing, I do have a clause in my contract that spells out that the client will be responsible for licensing for whatever platform or add-on that we use, particularly if it's a content management system that we're using. In the statement of work, I basically just say, well, these are the items that we're planning on using. I have a little asterisk that says, well, depending on what we run into, we may change this. So that cost is relatively minimal. And I've never had any pushback from a client, you know, if I have to go back in and say, well, every single one of these add-ons we're not going to be using because they just don't work with the solution that we came up with. Because the cost is relatively minimal, clients don't usually push back. And, you know, granted, if on the off chance that initial cost or that estimate for those items winds up being double what I expected, I'll always go back to the client before walking down that path and say, well, or this is how we're going to revise the statement of work so that we can solve, you know, problems X, Y, and Z, and it could potentially cost this. If the client pushes back and says, no, well, that's more than we wanted to spend on licenses for this stuff, well, then, okay, that's fine. We can take something out, or we can figure out another solution that will get around the problem.
Do you then purchase the add-ons on behalf of the client since it's part of the agreement, or do you just tell them, here are the add-ons and here are the solutions, and then now I'm going to invoice you? Or do you just tell them, okay, I need these add-ons, you purchase them and give them to me?
I've found it easier over the years just to purchase the add-ons that we need to use and then bill the client for them.
Okay.
Anytime that I've left it up to the client to purchase the add-ons and send me the license numbers, we burn days or weeks waiting for them to do that. We just take care of that. It just simplifies things.
Okay. Now, when you do have these statements of work, especially if the project goes out of scope or changes and you need to make a new statement of work, is that something that you have a lawyer look at, or is that something that's just, you know, you feel confident that you're protected with those?
It depends on how much of a change is coming down the pipe. If it's a scope item that completely blows the scope of the original statement of work, we'll write an entirely new statement of work. The old one just closes, and then we'll start from there. Depending upon what it is they're asking for, 9 times out of 10, because of the fact that I separate the project specifics from the contract, I've been handling the statement of work myself. Mm-hmm. And at least up to this point, that I've gotten into a situation where I would have to run that by an attorney as well. Having said that, it is something that, depending upon the client, I would take to an attorney as well and say, can you just take a look at this and, you know, make sure everything is copacetic before we move forward. The key thing that I found in terms of dealing with client is just making sure that you're being upfront and honest about what the cost is going to be. If a client is comfortable with the cost, 9 times out of 10, you can resolve any issues that come up yourself. I don't really feel the need that, I should say that I would disagree with the opinion that every single document that you create or produce for a given client has to be vetted by a lawyer. You know, that being said, if your company is making enough money where you can have a lawyer on retainer, great, run everything past them. But for those of us that don't have the income to be able to pay a lawyer, you know, up to $1,500 a month or more to be on retainer so that they can review every single contract, I don't see that being necessary. The other side of the issue, too, is that from my perspective, I don't have enough new work coming in the door every week or every month to warrant having a lawyer on retainer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, up to $1,500 just to have somebody on standby when I could go 2 or 3 months without getting a new contract in the door. So for me, you know, working on an hourly basis with a lawyer fits my business and business practices a little better at this point in time. I mean, that may change, but that's kind of how I approach things right now.
You mentioned earlier in our discussion that there are certain areas of that contract, right? I think you refer to as the master services agreement that you're willing to sort of negotiate with a client on. Can you talk about that a little bit more? Are there any areas where you always remain firm and inflexible to what a client might want to change?
I would say that the primary area that I'm completely inflexible with a client is with regard to intellectual property. Intellectual property is kind of a sticky wicket in that, you know, every single person has a different way of defining what intellectual property means. And that goes for the designer, developer, even a lawyer or your client. They all have a different perspective on what it means. For me, the intellectual property that I am turning over to the client when a project is done is the product that I create, right? And that product, you know, if it's a website, the intellectual property that I am turning over are the files that comprise the website. And that means that I'm turning over all of the imagery. I'm turning over the code. I'm turning over the license for EE. And that is what they're purchasing from me. Another soapbox issue for me within the general industry as a whole, the creative industry, is that there are a lot of companies out there that believe that turning over a PSD is part of the intellectual property of I completely and utterly disagree with that. The client is not buying my source files. What they are buying is the finished product. Mm-hmm. And I've stated this argument in the past that when you go to a clothing store and you buy a new dress, you know, say you walk into, I don't know, some couture store and they're selling a dress for $10,000. Well, when they sell you that dress, they're not selling you the pattern for that dress.
Mm-hmm.
They're selling you the product. So that's kind of the same way that I approach my business as a whole. And because of the fact that I started off as an illustrator in this business, I have a much different perspective on what intellectual property means. Much like the way that a photographer sells his work, when you go to iStock Photo and you purchase a photo, you're paying iStock Photo for the right to use that photo in one place. And most people don't get this, is that, and I've found this with clients as well, that they will buy one photo and they will use it 100 different places. That's actually against the contract or in violation of the contract that you sign. You're only paying for a single use. And that's the same way that an illustrator approaches the business as well, that when I do an illustration for somebody, they're paying for a specific use. And that goes for if I'm doing a design for a website, that's the only place that I'm selling them the right to use it for. If they want to use it as a logo or they want to put it on a t-shirt or any kind of merchandising or in advertisements, billboards, TV spots, well, guess what? That's an additional fee because they're using it in an additional place. I've had a lot of people argue this, but the bottom line is that if you sell the right to a client, or I should say if you sell a product to a client or you turn over a PSD to a client, they can take that PSD and start doing your work for you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, or they can hire somebody else who's cheaper than you, hand over the PSD that you created, and then that person who is less expensive already has a leg up and they're able to, you know, do the work. So for me and from my perspective, that's the one area within intellectual property that I'm absolutely inflexible with. Now, larger companies, for example, is it Happy Cog or is it Engine? Might be Engine. I was speaking with Carl about this. In any case, the way that they approach their contracts is that they already have built into the contract fees for all of the source materials.
Mm.
They can charge enough and they can get the contracts in that are large enough to make that worthwhile. For smaller companies, when a client comes to me and they says, we need a website and we only have $10,000 or $15,000 to spend, they very rarely also have the additional funds to be able to say, okay, well, we want all of the source material for this project as well. Because I do have in my contract that it will cost it will require payment of an additional fee if they want that source material.
How much is that an additional fee? Like, how do you quote based on what the source files are?
I usually just look at it from the perspective of a percentage.
Okay.
If it's a very, you know, it's a very complicated project, and I've done a tremendous amount of work on, you know, creating the PSDs, and maybe I've got some little tricks in there. Everybody has a different way of working in Photoshop, and a lot of people know a lot of things other people don't know. And that particular document could be a nice little lesson for somebody that doesn't know how to do something. From that perspective, I just take it as a percentage and say, well, it's going to cost 75% of the total cost of the project, or it's going to cost 100% or 200%. It just depends on what it is. Mm-hmm. From the standpoint of an illustration, if somebody wants to buy the original illustration, and that's part of the deal, my costs there are typically 200%. Mm. It's kind of like buying the negative in photography. A photographer doesn't ever sell the negatives. They sell an individual photograph. And if you purchase the negative, that means that you have the ability then to create more samples or copies of that work.
Earlier, you mentioned that nowadays, the contracts that are between you and a client is something that you've presented to the client. But back before when you were a freelancer and you were signing more, you know, contracts from the client, were there any areas that were red flags to be on the lookout for when you are, you know, receiving a contract from a client that they want you to sign?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The two biggest red flags that I always look for, one was a work for hire clause and the other was non-compete clause.
Non-compete clause.
Yeah. I'll start with the non-compete clause first because it's the easiest to understand. Non-compete basically means that a company is asking or basically saying that we will work with you if you agree for a period of 2 to 5 years or more that you will not work with other companies within our industry. All right. So basically what they're trying to do is prevent you from working with our competitors. In some instances, you're not going to be able to get away from that. The larger the company that you work with, the more likely you're going to be signing some kind of non-compete provision. However, you can negotiate how broad the description of that non-compete is. Years ago, I had a local client who I had worked with for 6 years. It was an advertising agency that was bought out by a larger global advertising agency. So they basically just became an arm on a giant octopus of worldwide agencies. And they sent me a new contract as a result. And these were folks, again, that I'd worked with for 6 years. They trusted me. We had a good working relationship. I knew most of the, you know, most of the art directors and the creative directors and even the art buyers. And the new contract not only had a work for hire clause in it, but it also had non-compete. And the non-compete in one of these particular contracts said something to the effect of, you will not work with other agencies, and I'm paraphrasing, you will not work with other companies for 10 years plus something else, you know, within this industry. So, except that, you know, say I'm working for Coca-Cola and Coca-Cola gives me a non-compete that says you're not able to work with any other companies within the sphere of what we do.
Well, oh my gosh. Yeah.
So what does that mean? That means that you're not going to be able to work with any other soft drink companies. You're not going to be able to work with, you know, potential ad agencies or whatever it may be who are working with them as well. So it can be extremely prohibitive. Again, it's just one of those things that, you know, when I'm reading through a contract, that it's one of the first things I look for. And it's almost always separated from all of the other provisions in the contract. It will say, you know, non-compete, or I forget what the other specific way that it's referred to. But the bottom line is you're just looking for covenants that are restricting who you can work with. The second item that I always look for is a work for hire clause. This is probably my single biggest soapbox issue in this industry, mainly because it's not understood to the degree that it should be. And as a result, particularly inexperienced people are signing contracts that they shouldn't. In general, work for hire is a provision in the U.S. Copyright Act that it allows for a very narrow exception to the basic rule that a contractor or a creative professional who creates the work owns the copyright to the work that he creates. Right, that's a very important concept. For the most part, all of the work that you create, whether you're an illustrator, whether you're a writer, whether you're a designer, you, just by nature of putting pen to paper and creating a visual or writing something, putting a word on a piece of paper, you own the copyright to that work. What work for hire does is it subverts that. work for hire is designed to treat a contractor as though he's a full-time employee, but they don't have to pay him any of the benefits of being a full-time employee. So essentially what they're doing is treating you as though you're a member of the company. And what that allows them to do is essentially, again, for lack of a better way of putting it, kind of steal your right of authorship and your right to the copyright to the work that you create. And within a contract, some of the buzzwords that you'll see, or even in discussions with clients, they'll refer to work for hire using such buzzwords as invisible, silent, or white labeled. So essentially what they're telling you is that you don't exist. If they white label you, that means that, oh, well, we want you to pretend that you're part of the company, even though we're contracting this work to you. We want you to pretend like you're an employee so that we don't have to tell our clients that we're outsourcing the work. And what all of this means then is that by signing work for hire, you're essentially signing away your rights to the work that you create. And the interesting thing is I after my talk at EECI in 2011, I got a little press out of that. And I ended up receiving an email from a lawyer out in San Francisco who had read through my stopworkforhire.com website and said that, well, I agree with everything that you say, but you're kind of being dishonest in the way that you're portraying this. Because as she put it, websites, web design, web development, and software development are inherently work for hire. And my response to her was, well, no, it isn't. And if you read the U.S. Copyright Act, there are 9 categories that the U.S. Copyright Act specifically states as falling under a work-for-hire agreement. And the things like newspapers, magazines, anthologies, motion pictures, translations, any kind of compilation, or things like atlases. So basically, what they're describing are types of work that incorporate dozens and dozens of different people who are contributing to it. And the reason why that's important, or I should say why that's necessary, is because you can't have, say if you're doing a poetry anthology, you can't have 50 different contributors on a project claiming a right to that work. You can't have 50 different people, you know, stating that, well, if I work with this, then, you know, these are my demands. You know, they're contributing to it, and there's typically one editor who is in charge of that entire project. So that's where work for hire comes into play. Now, the way that it's subverted by advertising agencies, design firms, and, you know, just general corporations is that because the law is somewhat amorphous, and there are some words in there like audiovisual work, that they can say, oh, well, we're going to treat web design development or the software development that we've outsourced as a work made for hire. So technically, it doesn't fit within the Copyright Act itself or the clause within the Copyright Act. But the only things that a company needs to be able to claim something as work for hire is technically they're supposed to have, or within the contract, the words work for hire need to appear. But there's a loophole. There are all sorts of, I've read over the years, I've collected contracts that people have been sending me that have very specific work for hire clauses that do not state that they're work for hire. So the loophole is that the words work for hire don't actually need to be in the contract. And the only thing that a company needs to enforce a work for hire clause is your signature. Once you sign that, you are agreeing to every single provision that that work for hire agreement, you know, entails. So it's a bit of a problem because, you know, there are all sorts of ways that companies can get around work for hire agreements. And I've received contracts from clients that have work for hire language specified in 3 different locations within the same contract. Companies send me a work for hire agreement separate from the actual contract, which also had work for hire language in it. And I've also received paychecks from companies with work for hire language on the back of a paycheck. And by cashing that paycheck, you are agreeing to work for hire, even though it wasn't in your contract.
Crazy. Wow.
Wow.
So when you have these situations where a client is giving you a contract and you want to, you know, push back on the work for hire, but the other side of that, when you have your own agreement, do you have to specify something in that agreement that you are an independent contractor and not an employee and all that other stuff to protect yourself?
Yes and no. Within my own contract, that is pretty much covered within the intellectual property clause. And it basically states you know, within my contract basically states that I'm not an employee of the company. You know, these are the basic rights that I'm reserving for myself. This is what you can expect for your intellectual property rights. I do my best to detail all of that. So the answer to the question is yes, it is in my contract.
All right. So we've taken a lot of your time today, and we kind of did that on purpose because I think this topic is so important.
I could listen to this for hours.
I know. I wanted to squeeze as much out of you. But there is such a thing as, you know, reasonable time limits. So that is all the time we have for today. Thank you for joining us, Paul.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. It was a blast.
It was great having you. In case our listeners want to follow up with you, where can they find you online?
Well, you just Google 16 Toads and you'll be able to find me. So, yeah, I'm on Twitter at @16Toads. My website is 16toads.com, and if they want to contact me via email, it's just paul@16toads.com.
Perfect. All right, so now we'd like to thank our sponsors for this podcast, Focus Lab and Pixel and Tonic.
We would also like to thank our partners, Engine Hosting, Devotee, and EE Insider.
Also, thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about the podcast, make sure you follow us on Twitter @EEPodcast or visit our website, ee-podcast.com.
And don't forget to tune in to our next episode when we'll be talking about digital marketing with Dana T. Tommaso.
This is Leia Alcantara.
And Emily Lewis.
Signing off for the unofficial Expression Engine podcast. See you next time.
Cheers.